Up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, an exercise physiologist explains why running is even more beneficial than walking.
They wanted to compare individuals who ran at a very gentle pace and compare them to individuals who walked.
Plus, an update on the diagnosis and treatment options for depression.
Psychotherapy is a great tool. It works, well for mild to moderate depressions. The more severe the depression is, I do think the thinking is you have to lean at least towards a medication at that point, sometimes with psychotherapy.
And new research initiatives in ophthalmology.
What we've uncovered is that one of the genes we study is related to a very obscure disease called Pugh-Soon's syndrome, and it's a blinding disorder that also has kidney problems.
We'll learn why we should eat our vegetables and hear a selection from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we learn about depression and what can really help. And we'll hear about some groundbreaking research into a cure for retinal blindness. But first, why is running more beneficial than walking? Running may reverse aging in certain ways that walking does not, according to a noteworthy new study of active older people. Here with more on this is Dr. Carol Sames. She's an exercise physiologist and associate professor in the College of Health Professions and the director of the Vitality Fitness Program at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Carol. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
So these findings for this study raise some very interesting questions about whether most of us need to pick up the pace of our workouts in order to gain the greatest benefit. Let's start with what this study was. Tell us what were they trying to find out?
Well, they wanted to look at older individuals. The mean age of these groups were 69 years old, and they wanted to compare individuals who ran at a very gentle pace and compare them to individuals who walked. And they wanted to look at this thing called walking economy. And economy is essentially, if we think about a car, we have cars that have different fuel efficiency economies. Some cars can go further at the same speed than other cars. And so they wanted to look at these individuals when they walked to see if there was a difference in the amount of energy one group used over the other.
Now, why is that so important? I mean, obviously, as we age, we want to be active. So walking, what role does walking play in our lives in general in terms of fitness or in terms of overall
health?
Just
overall health, absolutely. In fact, sometimes walking speed has been called the sixth vital sign. It's that important. We know that as individuals lose the ability to walk, slow down their pace, they have an increased risk of death from cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hypertension. So it's really all rolled together. So walking speed, walking economy is actually very important, especially as we get older.
But we do know that walking in general is excellent exercise.
Oh, very much so. It's movement, absolutely.
And the fact is that people who do walk throughout their lives and continue to walk for exercise also benefit. I mean, there have been studies that have shown that there's a lower incidence of obesity, arthritis, heart disease, diabetes, mm-hmm. much as you said, and longer lifespans than people who are sedentary.
Absolutely.
But this study was looking at something very particular, as you said, whether if a person ran versus walked at a certain age, if they could walk better
Correctly.
Than the people who just walked.
Right. Because what we know is that as we get older, regardless of how active we are, if you're just walking, people tend to lose their walking efficiency or their economy. And so they wanted to know, is this just something that is just age-related? Because we certainly know as we get older, we lose muscle mass. There are certain things that are, unfortunately, age-inevitable. So they wanted to know if this loss of walking economy was age-inevitable. And they had some surprising results.
So who did the study, and where did it take place, and how did they go about this?
Well, this was out of Boulder, Colorado, which is actually a very active area
of the country.
So they had 15 individuals who were regular walkers. They had been walking at least for 6 months, 30 minutes at least three times a week, and then they had 15 runners who also had been running for a minimum of 6 months, three times a week, 30 minutes at a shot.
So the pace of running wasn't that crucial, but the fact that they were that they were runners as opposed to walkers.
Right. And they weren't racers. They were running at a slow pace. So they weren't, you know, we would call them joggers.
Yeah, right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with exercise physiologist Dr. Carol Sames. And we're talking about the benefits of running rather than walking as we age. So what did they do? What was the study? What did they actually do?
Okay, so they took these 30 individuals and they put them on a treadmill. And they had three different walking speeds. One a slow walking speed, one more of a moderate speed, and one a quicker speed. And they looked essentially at their oxygen consumption to look at the amount of energy it took to walk at those three paces.
Hence the efficiency
idea. Exactly. And then they also looked at the mechanics, how much force they were placing on their legs, their stride length, how many strides they were taking at each one of these paces. And then they compared the runner group to the walking group. And essentially what they found, regardless of walking speed, the runners were more efficient. They used 7 to 10% less energy to walk at those three paces than the walkers did.
So what can we? What's the takeaway from that?
Well, the takeaway is that these individuals then would be able to do more activity. The runners were able to, you know, essentially using less energy means that you could go longer, that you could perform more work. And if I'm not able to perform work, then I tend to be less active. So if you think about it, it's a tremendous improvement to have less energy, which means I can do more activities. I can be more active around the house, maybe occupationally. I can play with my grandchildren for a longer period of time. So really the ramifications are a lot larger than just, oh, I can walk a few minutes longer.
Did they also compare the older runners' walking efficiency to that of young people?
Yes, they did. And so they looked at a previous study, not this particular study, but they had also investigated college-age students. And they looked and found that these runners were as efficient as sedentary college students.
Wow.
And that was pretty impressive. The walkers were 26% less efficient when compared to those sedentary college students.
So can you take away from this then that if they continue to run, that they were actually that they didn't experience that, as you said, the inevitable
right
effects.
Decline. Correct. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the take-home message. And what these investigators said is, as with all research, there are limitations. You know, all studies have limitations. The sample size was small. There was a difference in the number of men and women in each group. But beyond that, what they're saying is similar to what we're seeing in other research that talks about interval training, that if you can move a little quicker, so if I am a walker, can I speed up, slow down? Can I, if I'm on a treadmill, increase the grade, you know, walk up a hill? Because what they're thinking is that there's something that is going on at the muscle level.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about. What was their analysis in terms of the causation of this? I mean, what did they think was underlying it?
So they didn't actually test for that, but some of the theories are, and we know with more intense interval training, there's an increase in the number of mitochondria that we have, and mitochondria are our energy cells. So if I have more mitochondria, that means I can produce more energy, okay? So that's one theory. The other one, which is probably pretty strong, is that when you run, it requires a lot of coordination. So does walking, but running a little bit more so because you're moving at a quicker speed. And so they were thinking that the runners have better muscle activation and that they are, when they walk, the muscles that are utilized are more efficient at contraction versus the walkers. So again, they didn't test that, but it was one of the underlying hypotheses and one of their suggestions for future research.
Yeah, one of the things that strikes me, though, is when you look at a small sample like this, you had a self-selected group
Absolutely.
Of people who already were runners.
Right.
So that could skew your results. If Right. you were already picking people who, by nature, wanted to run, maybe they were a different category of person.
Absolutely.
In terms of their overall fitness level, in terms of their history, in terms of their overall health, mm-hmm. than the so-called walkers.
Right.
What's your thinking about how that may have skewed the
results? Oh, absolutely. And that's why I always say, you know, research is good. We need to have a foundation, but research needs to be replicated. And that's why we always have limitations to all research and suggestions for future research. You don't know. The runners might be running because they just were more efficient. You know,
always.
Just naturally
yeah.
more efficient.
And found that and maybe had run for their whole lives.
Right. Exactly.
Which also sets them apart. I mean, when they screened for who their random sample was, did they screen for their history, for example, on how long they'd been running?
Well, you know, because there's really not randomization here. It's all volunteers.
Right.
You know, you're not randomizing to a running group and a walking group. Like you mentioned, they're already running and walking. What was also kind of interesting, though, you would think that you might find a difference in the biomechanics of the two groups when they walked, and actually there was no difference in biomechanics. So there was no difference in stride frequency, you know, how many steps I was taking, how long I'm on one step before I start to move forward. So there were no differences there. So that's kind of interesting because you would tend to think that maybe there would be a difference in the biomechanics.
But in what direction?
That the runners maybe would be more efficient. They would have a longer stride, a faster frequency, because obviously jogging is quicker than walking. But when the runners walked, there was no difference between those
two. So what's the bottom line here? I guess the question is it the kind of thing where, based on a small study like this, you as a professional would encourage people who maybe have been active older adults who walk primarily, would you encourage them to start running, for example?
Probably what I would encourage is some little intervals first. You know, running is not for everyone. There's risk involved with running. There actually is more force when you land running versus walking.
And if you have issues with arthritis
Absolutely.
Or osteoporosis
Correct.
Or what have you, you could probably
potentially injure yourself.
Injure yourself, right.
So with the walkers, what I would say is if you're able to, it'd be great to add some intervals. I walk a little quicker, I slow down. I walk up a hill because that acts like intensity. And this research really corroborates the research that's coming out now on interval training and how you really can get more bang for your buck from a cardiovascular standpoint. So, and the authors also suggest that it might not just be running. Maybe if I ride my bike, I ride a little quicker, or I'm on a recumbent, a stationary bike, I ride a little quicker, and then I back off, and then I ride a little quicker. You know, they even suggest it could possibly transfer over to swimming if people swim, or use the elliptical or other pieces of exercise equipment, that there are some benefits to this idea of interval training if an individual is able to do that type of training.
So the concept with interval training, though, and I think you and I have talked about this before, is the idea that you're stressing the system a little bit more and then allowing for recovery.
Correct.
So
yes.
So it's not really just a long, steady slog, but the idea of kind of speeding up, slowing down, speeding
right.
up, slowing down. And would you say that from your standpoint as a professional looking at all of this, that really is kind of the crucial takeaway?
It certainly is. Again, we want people to be active. And so I don't want people to think that, I'm going to ditch the walking program because there are many benefits. But if you want to have additive benefits, interval training certainly for the right individual can be very beneficial.
How about adding things like weight to that? In other words, weight training as part of it.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, in the Vitality program, one of the things that we really try to stress is the importance of strength. In fact, I would place strength training initially. If you had somebody that was completely deconditioned, older, I would actually aim for strength training first and then gradually add in more aerobic or cardiovascular activity. You need muscle to move. And if you don't have that muscle, it really doesn't matter if you want to walk or jog, because if you don't have the muscle to be able to perform those activities, and just think about activities of daily living, just living in my house. I mean, you need to have muscle to do all those activities.
So in the very little bit of time we have left, what are the kinds of things people can do to work on strength training? I know there's a world of it.
Well, you don't even need any equipment. You can do things like wall sits, which I believe we had discussed, where I'm up against a wall and I slightly bend down with a nice straight back. Sit to stands, sitting up out of a chair without using my arms. You can do wall push-ups. I mean, there are all kinds of things that you can do to maintain strength. We can do sit-ups in a chair. So it's really important to have that strength, because that strength then enables me to be able to move. So.
And in some sense, that's what really generates longevity.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Carol. Once again, it's always so inspiring to hear you. My guest has been Dr. Carol Sames, exercise physiologist and director of the Vitality Fitness Program at Upstate Medical University. Coming up next, all about depression and what can help. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. The recent tragic high-profile deaths of actors Philip Seymour Hoffman and comedian Robin Williams have once again reminded us that depression does not discriminate. Whether you're rich or poor, old or young, male or female, famous or not, you can have depression with the potential for severe consequences and even death. Joining us with more on this is Dr. Thomas Schwartz. He's professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Schwartz.
Great.
Thanks for coming in. Let's begin by helping us understand, when we use the word depression, what constitutes clinical depression, as opposed to, for example, as a medical condition? How is it different from simply feeling down, for example, or even sad or experiencing grief, for that matter?
So I think that's a great question and a great place to start. I think feeling sad or feeling grief is a crummy but normal feeling. We all have it. It's within the realm of normal. So one thing we don't want to do is just say, if you're sad, you must be depressed, go get a medication. So I think it's a great place to start. So one idea we would always ask, is the person appropriately sad? You know, if this had happened to you, would you be sad? Would you be sad for a minute, a day, or 3 weeks? You really try to normalize it within the human condition. So we all have blues, sadness, grief, and I don't think I would medicate those. I do think some people would need counseling, psychotherapy. Other people just need good friends. And you kind of move through and go through the motions of being blue and down, and people then gradually bounce back. And that's probably within the realm of normal. What we would look for is somebody who's sad, down, or blue out of proportion to what had just happened, for example, or somebody that stays down or blue longer than the average person. And then we start thinking about clinical depression or major depressive disorder. We also look at the severity. You can be so down or grief-stricken that you don't eat, you don't feed yourself, you don't bathe, you can't get to work. If you start failing in your daily obligations or self-care, it's probably a bit more than regular blues or regular grief. And at the other extreme, if you start hearing voices, you have hallucinations, you get paranoid, you get suicidal or homicidal, those are typically not felt to be part of the blues or grief. So whether it's 1 day, 2 days, 20 days, you're bouncing back or not, you can cross one of those lines where we kind of start checking the box. This is a clinical major depression.
So what is the incidence of that actually in the U.S.? I mean, how common is it to have clinical depression?
So I think there's numbers that, you know, range from, you know, let's say 1 out of 6, 5%, 12%, 20%. You know, it really depends, you know, who you read and what you look at. But I think it's fairly common. The difficulty, again, is deciding, you know, who crosses that line and becomes majorly depressed to where they need some sort of treatment. But it's actually fairly common, and it's one of the most disabling conditions in the U.S. and worldwide. It is considered a medical condition.
As a matter of fact, I read an interesting quote that over the next over the next 20 years, depression is projected to be the second leading cause of disability worldwide and the leading cause of disability in high-income nations, including the United States. So that's kind of quite serious.
Yeah, I think so. If you think of depression, it's not just being sad. People have low energy, there's amotivation, there's not a lot of drive, they can't focus or concentrate. There's also a problem with what we call presenteeism, where people who are depressed go to work, but they're relatively ineffective. They can't make as many widgets. They make more mistakes in accounting. And so there's a problem of not being able to go to work. And if you get to work, you're not still not functioning well. So it is a big problem.
Are there other potential health risks that also come with depression? I mean, do they find correlates in terms of either cardiovascular disease or that kind of thing?
So I think there's two ways to look at it. One is if you get depression for any reason, you're less likely to take care of your medical needs. So for example, if you have diabetes, you're less likely to follow a diet, do your finger sticks, take your pills or your insulin. So depression to me, if you already have a medical problem, will probably make that worse. I do think there are some correlations. The other way, you know, if you're depressed, you're more likely to have heart disease. You're more likely to have diabetes. I mean, there are things that just kind of travel together as well. So that happens in that direction too. So it is concerning when patients have both medical and psychiatric problems. They tend to have worse outcomes for both. They don't get as much better. Their depression doesn't clear up as much. Their diabetes doesn't clear up as much. So the more things you have going on, the more trouble you're usually in.
Makes a lot of sense. In addition to that pain and suffering that the individual feels, what is the impact on the families or the people who are surrounding this individual?
So what I typically see is actually it's a lot like when somebody in a family gets a cancer diagnosis, somebody gets a depressive diagnosis, or they're suffering from depression. I usually see family members, spouses, boyfriends, girlfriends, employers, clergy members, everybody swoops in. And there's this sense of we need to provide a lot of support and a lot of care, and there certainly is suffering. And then what I do notice as, let's say if the depression goes on, people start feeling helpless. Yeah, what I'm doing isn't helping. I must be no good. I'm scared. What if I say or do the wrong thing? And then people actually start separating themselves. So the tough part I see is there's an immediate swooping in of care, and then there's this kind of slow disintegration of social support for some people. And it's usually because we as the non-depressed person, I think, feel helpless and we can't help. Nothing's
Makes
working.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And again, in this world, we typically, if we see somebody crying, we want to console them and get them to stop. We don't tolerate sadness and others very well. And then somebody who's perpetually sad, it's also very hard to be with them.
Yeah.
So I think you do see that. So if you're working with family and support systems, I think just like patients with terminal illness, you have to let the support group work through what's going on with the patient too. And so that's a great intervention for some people.
Who do you think is most at risk for these kinds of things, for clinical depression specifically? I mean, what are the biological factors, psychological, or even cultural issues that make someone more apt to become depressed?
So I like the way you put it, the biopsychosocial model, and you could understand this in several different ways. Any one of us under enough stress could develop a depression. So maybe there's no genetics, there's no psyche or psychology, but you know, God forbid the house burns down, the dog runs away, you go through a divorce, you lose your job. Under any amount of stress, that changes your hormones, your neurotransmitters, and certainly the way you think. So I think one idea is you measure the amount of stress somebody is under, and that's a clear cause. Psychologically, we all have different personalities, different resiliencies, different coping skills. Some of those you're born with, some of those you learn from your parents, and some of our coping mechanisms are good, and some of them aren't so good, and they get us more stress. So if I'm more impulsive, I get stressed and I go gambling or drinking or getting in fights, that creates more stress for me. So that's a cause. And then the biology of it, I would suggest depression is probably 30%, quote, biological. If you look at genetics, it can run in families. You're going to be more predisposed if mom and dad and your aunts and uncles all had depression. So there is a genetic component too. And we would often argue that the brain is low on certain transmitters, like serotonin or norepinephrine. What really probably happens is different parts of the brain are underactive or hyperactive. Your brain is an organ, just like your heart, and if it's firing too much or too little, you can develop symptoms. So there certainly are some biological causes, and they all probably interact together. The issue really is you get a little bit of each of those, and the depression would start.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with psychiatrist Dr. Thomas Schwartz. We're talking about depression. So it's treatable, though. Obviously. Tell us more about what's the current thinking about treatment.
So I think treatment also follows this biological, psychological, social type approach. So one idea is if people are socially stressed, you know, if they're going through a divorce, they're impoverished, you really work with a patient through social work, case management, public entitlements. You really try to fix those things as best you can within reason to lower their stress level. Psychologically, if they have poor coping skills, maladaptive ways of dealing with things, you would do psychotherapy, and you would try to work with them to become more resilient.
To help with behavioral changes.
Yeah, and I think some people just get stuck in a depression, which changes their behavior. And you have to try to make people aware of they're stuck in a depressed-only thinking state. And all or none, this is all bad, nothing will ever work. And you really do have to work with people to see that there are some better things out there. So psychotherapy comes in, just like medications, comes in several varieties. Do you want to go once a week or twice a week? Do you want to come for 12 weeks or 2 years? Do you want to look at the here and now or your past? So we can actually, I would say, prescribe psychotherapy to try to match the patient's belief system, what they want to accomplish, how long they want to spend trying to get better. So psychotherapy is a great tool. I do think it works, you know, well for mild to moderate depressions. Works as well as any medication I could prescribe. The more severe the depression is, I do think the thinking is you have to lean at least towards a medication at that point, sometimes with psychotherapy. I've also met people that are so depressed they can't benefit from psychotherapy yet. You have to lower those symptoms so they can actually participate. So I do think the standard approach now is to discuss with the patient what they want to do. Some people hate medicines. We've got 9 different psychotherapies, let's say. Some people don't want to come in and talk or don't have the finances or the insurance, but I'd rather take one pill a day, and we've got, you know, say 20 different medicines. So I really think it's a negotiation with the patient, a partnership with the patient to try to find, you know, what they're motivated and accepting of.
So you can tailor basically the therapeutic treatment for them. But has the thinking changed in terms of the pharmacologic intervention? I know probably 10, 15 years ago we thought of things like Prozac as the silver bullet. Mm-hmm. Has the thinking changed?
So, you know, I think it probably depends what circles you operate in as a clinician. And if you're a psychotherapist, there certainly is a movement back towards psychotherapy. I think more psychiatrists are still more in the medication management area. I actually do think there's been more of, again, this blending of both in meeting the patient, you know, where they're comfortable. So I do think there's been this trend towards nobody's right and nobody's wrong. It's you have to discuss all options with the patient, see what they're comfortable doing. When in doubt, we typically do both. I do think that both treatments treat different parts of the brain, different parts of the psyche. So we do use a combination an awful lot.
What would you recommend to someone, especially, you know, winter, this time of year, the kinds of things that we've been seeing, you know, the darkness, all that probably contributes somewhat. If you have someone in your family or a friend who you think has clinical depression, what advice would you offer people?
So I think one key thing is to ask people, you know, how they're feeling, how they're doing. We're really training doctors to ask simple questions like that. What's your mood been like? And if somebody really is stuck, they're pervasively, they only have one mood, and it's sad, down, and irritable. You never see them brighten up. They're never more motivated. It really is the sense of being stuck. You might start asking if they're depressed. Have them look up what depression is on a bona fide, you know, website. Get people self-educated, motivated to ask their family doctor, clergy member, best friend. But the more you start talking and just inquiring, I think people then get motivated for treatment.
In the very little bit of time we have left, I read a staggering statistic that somehow almost 50% of people who are diagnosed with major depression don't receive any kind of treatment. Do you think that's lack of services or stigma or both?
It's probably both. Stigma's gotten, I think, much better, but still people really don't want to self-disclose and talk about these things. And services are sometimes hard to get. Family practice doctors are busy treating 9 different problems. There's not a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists. So I really think it's a mixture.
I can't thank you enough for coming in. It's such an important conversation to be had. And as you said, if you have someone in your life who you think may be suffering, start the conversation. My guest has been Dr. Thomas Schwartz, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi. This is Maureen Franklin, registered dietitian for this week's Healthy Eats segment. We all know how vegetables are good for us, but do we know what nutrients are in them and how they can benefit us? Let's take a look. Vitamin A is important for healthy eyes, skin, and the immune system. Good sources are yellow-orange colored vegetables, such as bell peppers, winter squash, and pumpkin. Vitamin C promotes healing, helps the body absorb iron, and supports skin and bone health. Good sources are tomatoes, bell peppers, sweet potatoes, and dark green vegetables. Vitamin K supports blood clotting. Good sources are dark green leafy vegetables such as spinach, kale, and Swiss chard. Fiber can be beneficial for gastrointestinal and heart health. All vegetables are a good source of fiber. Potassium supports healthy blood pressure. Good sources are tomatoes, potatoes, sweet potatoes, winter squash, broccoli, and legumes. Magnesium is important for the proper function of nerves and muscles and the proper growth and maintenance of bones. Good sources are legumes, broccoli, squash, and green leafy vegetables. So now that you have an idea of the nutritional benefits of vegetables, how can you add more to your daily intake? Start with a familiar vegetable that you like. This is an easy way to increase your intake. For example, I love tomatoes. You could add them to your favorite grilled sandwich, add them to a casserole dish, or combine it with another vegetable for a cold salad, like a tomato and cucumber salad. Start with a small goal, such as to include vegetables at lunch 3 times a week. Try your favorite vegetable a new way. If you've always steamed or boiled Brussels sprouts, try roasting them. I know I did, and I loved them. This gives them a new texture and taste, and you might end up eating more. Keep vegetables in sight. Keep a dish of celery, carrots, and pepper strips in your refrigerator at your eye level. How often have you forgotten about those vegetables in the vegetable bin? Remember, vegetables just aren't for dinner anymore. Enjoy vegetables in a breakfast omelet, or in a smoothie, or grill them in a pita for lunch, or a pick-me-up soup. Want more ways to increase fruits and vegetables? Go to choosemyplate.gov for additional ideas and recipes. This has been Maureen Franklin, registered dietitian, with your serving of Healthy Eats.
Some groundbreaking research into retinal blindness. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. It's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of January 12th. Get the green light. Moderate exercise is beneficial to almost everyone, but those with asthma, diabetes, arthritis, or heart, lung, and kidney disease must take special care. If you have these or other limiting health conditions, check in with your doctor. You should also consult with a physician if you'd like to engage in vigorous activity and you're over 55, mostly inactive, smoke, have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or a family history of heart disease. Get ready for your healthy goals by making a doctor's appointment this Monday. Start off with a green light and you'll be racing to the finish in no time. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Pathologies of the blood vessels of the retina are among the major causes of blindness worldwide. Any abnormality affecting the retinal blood vessels during their development, or even at later stages of life, will lead to these severe pathologies. And research has recently shed light on the mechanisms that regulate retinal vascular development, and they offer hope to reaching the goal of preventing and treating blindness caused by these pathologies. Here with more on this is Dr. William Brunken. He's professor of ophthalmology and of neuroscience and physiology at Upstate Medical University. Dr. Brunken is also the new vice chair for research for ophthalmology at Upstate as well. Welcome, Dr. Brunken. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks very much, Linda.
So you've been engaged in research into retinal pathologies responsible for blindness for quite some time. Give us a little bit of an overview of your work.
Yeah, sure. I started my graduate work actually in New York State, actually at SUNY Stony Brook. And we moved from there in what seems an embarrassingly long time ago in 1980 to New York City, where I finished my work in at NYU. And then I moved from there on to a postdoctoral fellowship at Washington University and then the faculty at WashU. My early work was really focused on how the neurons of the retina talk to each other. And what I was really interested in is how neural networks form connections between each other and, in fact, how they talk to each other. And the idea was that we could identify then specific circuits that use different chemicals to talk to each other, and that would underline disease. And in fact, when I moved my laboratory from St. Louis to Boston, what we did is we identified a mechanism, a transmitter mechanism, a neurochemical mechanism in the retina that uses the neurotransmitter serotonin. Serotonin has now become quite famous because it's at the heart of many depressions. Our lab was the first lab to show that you could actually separate serotonin uptake into different neurons. So this led to a very fruitful area. But from there, I got interested in what are what we call in the field epigenetic mechanisms. That is, things that lie outside the genome. The human genome is about 20,000 genes. And our genome is 99.9% like a chimpanzee's and about 99% like your average dog. Mm. We're clearly not a chimpanzee nor a dog. And so the mechanisms that direct who we are and who we are as a species as well as who we are as people clearly are not just in the genome. And the
in fact, it's the epigenetics, it's the things outside. It's almost like the environment that the genes find themselves in.
Exactly. So this is very much like the sort of debate in nature versus nurture for children. When you have, do children adopt bad behaviors because they have bad genes, or are they in a bad environment?
Right.
And in fact, it's both of those
things.
It's a combination of those things. And so what we launched on then was taking our knowledge of basic circuits in the retina, what are the epigenetic mechanisms? And I focused in on a group of molecules that are called laminins. These are molecules of the extracellular matrix. The extracellular matrix are the proteins that surround all cells. They provide the substrate that cells live in and on.
They're homes.
Couches for being couch potatoes, the highways that they migrate on when they need to move from one place to another, and actually also the signposts that give them direction, telling them which is up, which is down, which is left, which is right. And these molecules are absolutely critical for embryonic development. In fact, they're the earliest ones, they're some of the earliest ones that turn on, and they're expressed early in human development, as well as mammalian development, but also in the animal radiation, that is, in animal evolution. These molecules appear just when metazoans appear. And a metazoan is an animal that has different kinds of tissues. So when we were all single-cell things, you didn't need these molecules because every cell was identical. Once cells came together to make an organism that had to have a mouth and a gut and an eye of some sort, you needed these molecules in part to help differentiate what
those cells... To tell the cells what to be, who to be,
how to grow, how to develop, and what type of cell to become.
Absolutely.
How to mature.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've been working on. And what we know that these molecules, by using genetic mechanisms, we can manipulate these genes in a mouse. We've taken out things that are called lamin beta 2, gamma 3. Their names are not really important to your audience. What's important is the the concepts. We can take the genes out, and we perturb development in what becomes an observable way. So we can go back and ask, how are these related to human disease? What we've uncovered is that one of the genes we study is related to a very obscure disease called Pucson's syndrome. It was a French doctor who identified it, and it's a blinding disorder that also has kidney problems. Another one of our genes, in collaboration with a group at Yale, we've identified is associated with autism.
Really?
The autism is a result of the defects that we've now published in brain development. And so these things are guiding how cells take on their fate, their names, whether they become X cell or Y cell or Z cell, and in what order.
So these are the signaling mechanisms, as you said, and the directives that these cells abide by. So what is the clinical, direct clinical significance of that, those types of findings?
So one clinical finding is, of course, the relationship to human congenital disease. But that, on some level, is the most trivial of the things. It tells us what the cause of the disease is. In large part, these molecules can't easily be fixed by...
Can or cannot?
Cannot easily be fixed by gene transfer. They're complicated genes, and there's a whole host of reasons why they're not. What's more probably important is their role in ongoing processes in the adult, and that's where the retinal vasculature comes in that you mentioned. So retinal vasculature in a human or a mouse is the responsibility of a set of cells growing over the surface of the retina that essentially call the blood vessels into the retina. They're not resident. And it's the complex interplay between the retinal neurons and those cells that cause the blood vessels to develop. Our molecules, laminins, are key interlopers, as you will, signaling elements between the neurons and these other cells called astrocytes in that process.
So, well, first of all, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with eye researcher Dr. William Brunken, and we're talking about his research into the causes of retinal blindness and the possible prevention. I guess I don't want to run out of time here. I just want to get to kind of a key point here. In all of these mechanisms that you found, are you saying that these findings will translate somehow into either prevention in terms of atypical development, in other words, in the developing mm-hmm. child, or also in perhaps the aging population where we're losing retinal capability?
So there are a couple of possibilities for serious development. The mechanisms for blood vessel development, unlike bone development or brain development per se, actually stay active. That's the reason why what we call neovascularization, new blood vessels, cause disease. We've got a good handle on the control of these new blood vessels with anti-VEGF. You've probably heard about, your audience has probably heard about this treatment. It's used all the time now.
For macular degeneration.
For wet AMD.
Right.
These are injections into the eye.
And it stops the...
It stops the blood vessels. But it doesn't work for everyone. And so we can develop some of the laminin molecules into a new form of longer-term therapy. But the other thing we can use the laminins for, and this has actually been accomplished in a first run in Japan, is to actually use the laminins and other components of the extracellular matrix to build new ocular tissues.
Wow.
So a group in Japan took extracellular matrix components, stem cells that you've heard about, and actually grew an eye in a dish.
Wow.
And we're doing at Upstate some of those kinds of experiments where we've partnered with people in the College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering in Albany, and we're developing what we're calling biomimetic scaffolds. That is, these are substrates just like nets that we build.
Like almost a structure upon which you can put cells.
That's exactly right. And this is a structure that a surgeon could then put, implant into the eye, and replace diseased tissue. This is a long way from being, you know, at the clinic, but it's a developmental plan which I think is well underhand now.
Well, that segues me quickly into your other hat, which is as the vice chair for research. Tell me a little bit more about what the department is doing. I don't want to run out of time. We have about 3 minutes left. Tell me more about what's going on in the department.
So what I got attracted up here from my native New York City to come and lead what is a world-class group of vision researchers. Longstanding director, Dr. Robert Barlow, died quite suddenly back in 2009, and the group needed a new leader, and they reached out to me. And we've got a group of essentially 8 vision researchers, mostly in the Department of Ophthalmology, but also in neuroscience and in neurosurgery, doing absolutely world-class research. The key now is to get that group and the group of very able clinicians, both here at Upstate and also throughout the SUNY system, interacting together. We've created this thing called the SUNY Eye Institute, which is a collection of researchers all across the state. That group of vision healthcare providers see 300,000 patients a year. That provides us an enormous access to translational research.
I just interrupt you a second. Translational being from basically bench to bedside.
From bench to bayside.
Yeah.
Bedside, yeah. And so this gives us a tremendous power, both in taking our basic research and making it clinically relevant, but also provides an incredible opportunity to develop an economy in the central New York area, which is actually based on high-tech biotechnology, something that with a combination of SUNY Buffalo, SUNY Albany, Syracuse, ESF, and in fact the University of Rochester, Central and Western New York is blessed with some real powerhouse educational institutions.
And again, do you feel that the government sequester and other issues that have kind of impacted or have potentially had a chilling effect on basic science research? How have those affected your work?
I have to divulge, I've been at this now for 30 years, and this is the worst period of time in my 30-year career. We are seeing funding levels that are just the worst ever. As a percent of GDP, the funding for scientific research by the federal government is the lowest it's been since the NIH was formed. NPR, aired these shows, did a very good series of stories about how bad the funding level is. And it is, in fact, really killing the industry. And what it's doing is not only hobbling people like me, who are in the middle of my career, or I'm actually getting to the last third of it. It's really taking away from the youth, the next generation, because they see how hard their mentors are struggling, and they just don't want this lifestyle.
Sure.
And so we're going to cede to Europe and Japan and to China the leadership
on the cutting-edge research.
On the cutting-edge research, and we're going to lose it. And we've had it for 40 to 50 years. But we're in danger of losing that.
Yeah. Is there any opportunity just to partner with private industry as a way of providing a bit more of a
infrastructure? There is. And pharma, big pharma and little pharma, are in a desperate state as well. Their pipeline for drugs is really low. So they're desperate for new ideas. The problem, however, is that pharma needs a short payout. They don't have a long-term plan. The government has always provided a long-term plan.
And all of this research takes a
time.
Long view.
It takes decades. And so what has to happen is pharma can step in for the last development phase, but they can't do the basic research to get it to essentially clinical testing.
Well, all I can say is we hope that somehow this will turn around as the economy starts to rebound somewhat. I want to thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. William Brunken. He's professor of ophthalmology and of neuroscience and physiology at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for joining us. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Sometimes the hardest part of an illness, ours or someone we love, is in the waiting. Our physician or nurse practitioner may have a good idea about what is wrong, may suggest some of the thoughts they're having, but usually they want to wait, run some tests, see what those tests say, and then call us back. And so we wait. Playwright, poet, and performance artist Janice Butler Holm captures this state of suspended animation, of stasis, concisely in her poem called Lab Limbo. There he was, sitting and waiting, hoping, sitting and waiting and hoping, hoping the news would be good. Sitting and waiting and hoping, he wondered and pondered. He wondered and pondered and waited and hoped. Sitting, he waited and wondered and pondered. He hoped for good news, how he hoped. Hoping, he sat and waited. He wondered, he pondered, he hoped, and he hoped. He sat there hoping, hoping and waiting. He wondered and pondered and hoped, how he hoped. Sitting and waiting, he hoped and wondered. He pondered with hope and wonder while sitting, while waiting. Waiting and wondering, sitting and pondering, he hoped for good news. There he was.
For joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore the personal journey of a cancer survivor and find out what does it mean to be a boring patient. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Congel and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.